interest statement. We, with Christine's help, printed up some potential ideas for things you could say. I know Christina has a disclaimer on here a little bit that she doesn't want to be responsible for telling you what to say, but if it can assist you in declaring your potential conflict of interest. And as she's explained before, being that this body is advisory, it's not possible for you in this capacity to have an actual conflict of interest. So anyway, if you don't mind the three of you going around and making a statement about your potential conflicts of interest.
I do not have a potential conflict of interest. I have a potential conflict of interest because I'm a homeowner in Springfield and I'm a residential realtor.
I have a potential conflict of interest because I'm a homeowner in Springfield.
Thank you. So today, primarily for the agenda items, what I want to go over is, in recapping a little bit last time, we talked about House Bill 2001 and how to integrate that into the Development Code Update project, or if to integrate that. The direction I received from this body last time was to go ahead and integrate that into the Development Code Update project at this point. So we'll talk some more about that and what I see as how that may impact the timeline for the project. And then I'd also like to get your input on some potential concepts or ideas for how we may implement House Bill 2001. I did provide you a sheet. Yours is clean. Mine's all scribbled on and highlighted. But this is from the Department of Land Conservation and Development. It's a two-sided, one-page kind of cheat sheet of House Bill 2001 that they released recently. It gives some of the key dates. It has a little bit of a timeline at the bottom. And I took that some of the information, specifically the timelines, and I've provided you with a revised project schedule. So you should recall having seen this project schedule previously. It's part of the approved community engagement plan for the project. So this is the revised version. And so I'd like to talk through this a little bit and then get your feedback. So with the direction to implement House Bill 2001, there's impacts both in scope of what that entails in terms of drafting new residential code, and then also in terms of the timeline for how we see that, how long we see that taking. I added some lines to this diagram, as you can see. Kind of the green line shows where we're at today, where the deadline or my timeline for completing a draft of the residential code for public release to start kind of the public review process and then to move into the adoption phase of the project. And then the two timeline or the two deadlines that the state has put on us now in terms of implementing House Bill 2001. So the state themselves, the Department of Land Conservation and Development, I think in combination with one other agency at the state level, I think they're supposed to work with Housing and Human Services or something like that. But they're going to come up with a model code of how they see that they'll release how cities could implement House Bill 2001. And also they're going to do rulemaking, so develop administrative rules for how to implement the legislation. So that's the deadline by the end of next calendar year to do those two things. We've been in contact with our state our department representative from DLCD and are trying to plug into that process and be involved with both elements of that, the rulemaking to the extent we can, and also the model code development. Our project, this code development project, as we've talked about, is out in front of that. And so anticipating how that ultimate model code and those rules will mesh with what we come up with for how we're going to integrate it into our code, we want to make sure we're in alignment as closely as we can be. So what I've, timeline-wise, what I've shown on here in terms of proposed revisions to the timeline is one, the third yellow bar down represents task 7, which is the public outreach for the housing code. I think it was Commissioner McGinney that mentioned taking the opportunity to do more public outreach. So I've proposed to extend that public outreach phase from one quarter to two, so from 3 months to 6 months. And not only because there will be more new concepts in the code with housing, but also just getting more public feedback on how to integrate now these middle housing types into existing neighborhoods has been mandated by the state. So in extending that public outreach portion out, then bumping the adoption process out beyond that, and that also, in bumping the adoption process out, in our minds helps serve another purpose, and that is it moves it beyond the deadline for DLCD to have their model code and rules done. So as we're moving through that adoption phase, even though it would be kind of late in the game, we at least wouldn't be 100% complete yet, and we could have an opportunity to potentially make some changes in depending on what comes out of the model code and rules. So that we saw as a benefit there as well, kind of again being out in front but still trying to anticipate and stay plugged in the process, but being able to respond accordingly if necessary. So any questions about any of that portion of the changes shown on there?
Do you see it realistic to have a residential code draft by the end of this year?
My answer is yes, I do. It's going to be tight. And I'm working on it as quickly as I can. A lot of it is, you know, there's going to be an internal review process within the city itself, engaging this body on that and my TAC, the Technical Advisory Committee, to provide input. It's going to be a big lift, there's no question. And I think my goal is to accomplish that. I think in my mind, what it sets up, and I think, here's Councillor Moe, he can join us.
Gave you all the takeaways. We're adjourning.
Oh, good time.
We got a to-do list for you. So I think...
Before we continue, though, Councillor Moe will need to do his potential conflict of interest real quick. We have to do our potential... All the committee members have to declare if they have a potential conflict of interest.
There's actually a sheet of paper there for you.
It's the second sheet that gives some
prompts. Sheet with, if you'd like.
I don't know.
So if you own you own property in Springfield that could be affected by the development code update?
Yes, I do.
So that would be the source of a potential conflict of interest.
So we're just talking about a revised timeline, Councillor Moe. Yeah, it's in your packet there in front of you if you want to dig through and find that.
So
back to your question about, or my explanation in response to your question is, the draft, the public review draft, may not be as refined as it otherwise might be. And I think that can be good and bad. I think in releasing that to the public to get feedback, especially since we're incorporating the House Bill 2001 changes, there's going to be, in my mind, a bit more discussion about what's in the code. The other thought I've had is, with the release of the public review draft, is again, having that not be as refined, but potentially having options in there. Like, there's a couple ways to do things, or a spectrum of things that could be done. And so using that public outreach phase as really providing some kind of constructive input on further developing and refining the code. So that's my goal, is to have a public review draft done for the release at the first of the year. But again, it may not be as kind of polished as it might otherwise have been initially envisioned in my mind.
Okay. I really appreciate the extension for public outreach because, yeah, this is a huge change. We've never done anything like this before. No state has done anything like this. So I'm looking forward to those conversations with community members. And I also just... I'm really appreciative that we're ahead of the game on this. 2.5 years may seem like a long time, but in planning terms, that's like 4 seconds. So, I think Springfield is ahead of the game here, and that we'll be able to have a draft to work with when the model code comes out think that's huge. So I feel fortunate to be working with a team that's ahead of this, because I know that other municipalities, just from my experience, have not yet started working on this, and it's going to be a crunch time. So giving ourselves that space is crucial.
Public outreach is real important. I've been on so many committees and stuff where we reach out there, and nobody shows up. How do we get
Yeah, and we've been brainstorming a bit on creative ways of doing public outreach, so you're right, it is critical. I always say sometimes it feels like trying to pull teeth to get people involved, and you missed the introduction of the gentleman here. He's from the public, just here to observe and stay in touch, but we're glad to have the public involved, so yeah. And getting the word out.
It's been one of my problems with Planning Commission and everything. We pass these things that staff gives us, and nobody shows up to comment on them, so we do the best we can. Then down the road, it doesn't work.
Sometimes it feels like a bit of feast or famine, too. It's like nobody shows up until they realize maybe something bad, and then they all show up, or but trying to proactively engage them up front. So any suggestions you have about ways to do that, I'm open ears. So.
I would tell you that the one thing that sticks out is the first time we have active code that has been rewritten is in the second quarter of 2021, right? Like, and so I think that's going to be a question that next time you talk to council is probably going to come up, right? Because there's a reason, there's a good explanation, but trying to draw that map from the point we're at today, right, through all the public outreach that has to happen and then all the adoption processes that have to happen is going to be, because it takes forever.
Yeah. And it does, and even this, the adoption process shown on here is 9 months. That, in my mind, is optimistic. I mean, we originally mapped the adoption process as part of the code audit project that we had the grant to do, and we mapped it as a year-long process. So condensing that, and depending on what the Planning Commission and the public and then through the City Council, how everything gets reacted to is going to determine whether that gets extended.
Yeah, that's just a point to clarify, because it's like when you're dealing with this, if there's so many curveballs because you've got so many steps you have to sort of jump through, that this is actually probably the best we're going to do.
So when your comment you just made about the first time we're going to have active new code is the first quarter of 2021,
right?
That's correct. But so okay. I'm just clarifying, is that comment that's a long time from now? Or, I mean, from the council's perspective, you're thinking they're going to think, why can't we get it done before that? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Because that's my first instinct when I look at it, right? And when I look at it and go, okay, let me think about what goes on in the planning process, it goes, okay, that makes sense, right? But my first, like, when I pick it up, I'm going, we've started this whole thing, right? And 2 years later, maybe we might have something that I can go out and show the public. The council's going to be the same way.
Yeah. And I'm sensitive to that, and especially now that we're talking about extending that, because I'm going to jump down and talk about the changes that are downstream from that on this timeline as well. So in my mind, with the direction to fully try to fully implement House Bill 2001 now, is really going all in. I mean, basically, I'm writing the code. Christina's definitely going to, she's part of the project team. Sandy's supervising the project, so it's a group effort. But primarily, there's not a big team of people working on it. And anyway, so in my mind, going all in on the residential piece, try to get it right, and try to meet the deadline of getting a draft code by the end of the year, and really looking forward to getting something done, and that is the residential piece, and the sooner the better, not delaying the housing any longer. We've talked about options of, you know, do we wait or do we put off the full implementation of House Bill 2001, and we talked about that last time. But so anyway, all that to say, I see bumping out the timeline for the next phase, the commercial industrial phase, the employment land phase is what I'm calling it, the orange bars in the middle, bumping those out. And so not starting the commercial phase, or the employment land phase in earnest until the beginning of the year, the end of this calendar year, at the time, I feel like if I can focus on the residential piece, get the code written in a draft form, and then be able to move focus onto the employment land phase, I see as that a more realistic approach at this point. Some of the dynamics that play into that is, one, we've been recruiting or been attempting to recruit for a technical advisory committee for the employment land phase and have only gotten 2 applicants for that. It's been a struggle over the summer. People have been busy or, you know, off enjoying their summer. So that dynamic has played into that decision a little bit. We see as basically suspending the recruitment at this point or easing back off the accelerator on it and just potentially leaving it kind of out there, but really relaunching the recruitment for that TAC at the first of the year. It'll be past the holiday season. You know, after the first of the year, people kind of get their heads back in the game of whatever they got going on in life and aren't distracted by the holidays as much. So we see that as a good opportunity to re-engage, relaunch an effort to recruit for that TAC, and then move full steam ahead through that commercial phase. And then, as you can see, then that trickles down into the third phase as well. It just kind of bumps everything out. Some of the things I've done to try to condense the timeline, to still not extend too far beyond what our original anticipated date was of completion for the whole project, is condense the, it would be task 9 and task 13. So those initial steps or tasks of the second and third phase, I've actually condensed those bars down from what was effectively 7.5 months down to 6 months. Some of the rationale behind that is that as we've geared up for this first phase, the housing phase, it's really been a lot of foundation building work for the larger project as a whole. So now that we're kind of in the groove more, I think once we're at those points, we won't have to kind of start from scratch. And I think those steps of those phases will go a little smoother. So any feedback or questions about any of that or any of those other changes?
You're experiencing the same recruitment problems with this as other things. And that's an ongoing problem with getting people.
Yeah, and again, we've been exploring ideas and creative ways to even involve a TAC and maybe not have to have them all come to a table for an hour meeting or a 2-hour meeting once a month or once every other month or whatever, you know, engaging people in different ways. So we're looking at ways to do creative things around even convening public meetings. So hopefully trying to get some input. And moving forward with or without it at some point too, potentially.
I think that the delay start of the second and third phase is really smart, especially with House Bill 2001. A lot of our community focus is going to be on that.
Right.
And for us to be able to have that, like Sophie had mentioned, that jump start, if you will, to be able to have as much time as possible and focus your time and energy on that, I think that's a heads up decision. Just really well done. I know y'all are a lean, mean team, and I can't believe you're doing it all, and I'm very impressed by this timeline.
Thank you. So part of, you know, Councilor Van Gorn, you mentioned discussing these same things with the council. So I will be in front of the council on the 23rd of this month, so in just a couple of weeks. We plan to bring all the same information to the entire council at that point and discuss that this is the direction we're moving and hopefully get agreement that that sounds good. If for some reason, you know, the entire council doesn't agree that that's a good idea, we would potentially revisit it. But I plan to present that this idea as how we plan to move forward, given the direction we've gotten from this body.
Yeah, I don't see anything that I'm concerned with. I mean, the only piece of advice I would have would be the, you know, as you're putting the presentation together, is to really kind of take a step back and just show an example of when we say go ahead and adopt, right? Like, how many steps is that actually? Because it is complex, and that's why it takes a while. And people will go, oh, okay, right? You'll save yourself a question down the road. Okay. The only other thing that I could see the council bringing up as a whole would be probably talking about your recruiting, right? Like, there's always some sensitivity about, you know, economic and, you know, business interests and making sure that the right people are in the technical advisory committee.
Mm-hmm.
But you may not have any information to share, so.
Right. I mean, I agree. We've reached out one-on-one to individuals, and some of the response we've got is, I'm too busy, sorry. You know?
That's a good thing.
It is. And so if and when there's any kind of a lull of some sort, you know, people are going to be beaten on the door, and it's like, we need to make things happen. So they might have more time on their hands, but we'll see. Okay. Well, that's all great input and feedback. I appreciate that. Thank you. At this point, I think what I want to do is talk more about potential ideas for implementing House Bill 2001. So as I'm drafting code, you know, some of the direction I feel that the project originally, for the project was given to me was moving down a similar direction of what House Bill 2001 is intending to do to begin with. We may not have been trying to go quite as far. So I'll just use an example. So the one element of House Bill 2001 says we have to allow duplexes on every lot, every residential lot or parcel where a single family home would be allowed. And in my mind, I read that it's regardless of density. So in theory, which we don't really have this problem, but if there was a subdivision that had been platted out there at the maximum density that's allowed in the low-density residential zone, and now everybody wanted to come in and make a duplex out of it, it would effectively double the allowed density in the zone without us being able to really say anything about it. Now, that's in theory. I don't think we're really going to face that. But in terms of how the bill is written, I think that's what it's saying. I don't think we have the ability to say you have to have at least a 6,000 square foot lot size to put a duplex on it. I think it says you have to allow a duplex on every lot.
What we could do is say you have to have a, we could, in theory, I don't think this would be something we want to do, but you could restrict where you allow single family houses to account for the possibility that there may be more duplexes and not provide smaller lot sizes for single family houses, but that would not necessarily help in the grand scheme of things.
Okay, so maybe there's, it reminds me of an ADU question that we kind of ran into, which was like, well, what's the smallest, you know, ADU you could see? So if the smallest lot size is 6,000 square feet, right, like what's the building, like is the building code gonna allow a duplex? What's the smallest duplex you could build?
And that's like 220 square feet.
So it like, wow. So
6,000 square feet is not really the smallest lot size we would see. We have lots that are.
We can, I mean, in our code today, the way our code is written, in theory, you could plat basically, I think it's right around 3,000 or 3,100 square foot lot sizes in the low density residential.
So, and in theory, it could like, in that small size, it could look like essentially two tiny ADUs next to each other. Right, that would be legal.
Yeah. I mean, it could be a duplex, like a 500 square foot duplex that's 250 square feet on each side.
Right, as long as you hit the setbacks.
Right.
There's one on Pioneer Parkway that's a very small duplex. I'm trying to think of where it is. Somewhere between C and F. Pioneer Parkways, but every time I see it, I'm like, that's a really small duplex.
So it's a big duplex.
Yeah.
Have you seen
that's
a lot
possible.
Of it might be an ADU, attached ADU. I think
two doors.
Some of the initial ADU applications, Sandy might be able to talk about this better, but some of the initial ADU applications, if you were to hand someone the building footprint and not tell them that they came in as an ADU, you would look at that and go, oh, it's a tiny duplex. There's an 800 square foot unit and a 1,000 square foot unit, and it's just a smaller duplex than we might otherwise see. Or, you know, and because that, I don't know if that's continued, but when I had looked at like the first five or something we got, there were a handful of them that were attached ADUs, but it would be very difficult from the street to identify which one of those was the ADU. So it's a sort of a workaround to get a smaller duplex.
Well, and there's one being built right now, the foundation's poured on 4th and D, just right over here. And I don't know if they're going to be two-story or not, but when you look at this foundation, it's there's going to be two units on that foundation, and it's small. I mean, I don't know if they're going up, so it's going to be the footprint times two. But and then they're actually going to have a third unit on that site, so there will be three units on that little corner lot. But anyway, so with the duplexes and with all of House Bill 2001, the legislation gives us the ability to have siting and design regulations. As long as those siting and design regulations don't, I'm going to read the line, discourage the development through unreasonable cost or delay. So, you know, again, those words are subjective, and so they'll be tested over time. And through the rulemaking and the model code, I think the state will come out with guidance on that subjective language. They may or may not. Hopefully they provide a little bit of sidebars for what that means. With ADUs, they, with House Bill 2001, they put some sidebars on reasonable regulations for ADUs and said it's not reasonable to require on-site parking for ADUs, and it's not reasonable to require owner occupancy of ADUs. So that was new, where it was left vague before. So I can only imagine with the rulemaking, they may or may not try to do some of that clarification, and or in whatever model code language they come up with, they may provide more concrete examples of what the state thinks are reasonable regulations. So, but again, since we're out in front, trying to anticipate what we think for our community, we think reasonable regulations are. In looking at our existing code, we make a cutoff between duplexes and everything more than a duplex. So we call triplexes and above fourplexes, we treat triplexes the same as a 40 unit apartment building. And so triplexes, fourplexes, all the way up to what, how many ever multifamily apartment complex are all basically treated the same. So we're being asked to, in my mind, draw a different line. We're being asked to draw the line differently in for at least triplexes, fourplexes, and cottage housing and townhomes because of legislation. So this subset of multifamily housing now needs to be treated differently than a 50-unit apartment building or whatever. So what are those reasonable standards conceptually for now these middle housing types? I just brainstormed kind of a list. You have this sheet in front of you. And this little couple of diagram pages is directly out of the state's model code, which is fairly old at this point. I think it's probably 15 years old. But these are some examples. And again, this model code was developed years ago for small cities, which I think in seeing what the state anticipated it being used for, Springfield doesn't qualify in my mind as a small city that would necessarily use this development code, but it could. When I worked in Bend back in the 2000s and we rewrote the entire development code for the city of Bend, we used the state's model code as the starting point at that time. But anyway, these are just a couple pages excerpts out of their architectural standards for multifamily housing development. So we have some language in our existing code today very similar to this. We even use some of these same type of diagrams that were pulled from the model code. So in my mind, it's finding the balance, right? And so it's preventing the worst from happening, but not being heavy-handed about it or trying to prevent good development or creative development from happening. So some of the, you know, options in my mind include having a list of, say, and I think that there's even a list on here, in the model code. So the bottom of the second page is detailed design. So I don't know how many things, A through N are whatever, 12 or 15 different things. So it's a menu of options. So if we say, you know, for any new duplex, pick four of those things, or two of those things, or half a dozen of those things. So they need to be clear and objective. We need to be very specific about, they know exactly, they put 4-inch window trim around the windows on the front of the house, or all the windows of the house, or whatever it may be. But it's trying to have some design regulations to, again, I'll use the phrase, prevent the worst from happening, creating really ugly housing, because one of our goals is to have a beautiful community at the same time we're trying to provide housing. Or do we just say, you know, we're not worried about the worst from happening, we're not going to regulate design of duplexes at all. So somewhere on that spectrum, it's like conceptually or from a policy level, where do we want to land? So I don't know if you have thoughts about that or want to talk about it. I think we can draw a line differently too between the duplexes, and then also talk and have a different bar set, how high we set the bar for the triplexes and fourplexes and cottage housing and townhomes. So we could treat those differently as well. I mean, maybe we want to be completely hands-off on duplexes. But for triplexes and fourplexes and the others, we want to have a little more design requirements. So those are some of the things I've been thinking about and trying to figure out. Again, being ahead of the state and anticipating where we as a community feel good about trying to land for us in our code. How do we want to kind of go?
So I like the menu of options, right? Like from a design perspective, I think that makes a lot of sense. That hey, choose. I don't know if 2 to 3 is the right number, but like I like this format very mm-hmm. much, right? As a way from a design perspective, because it allows some variability, and then we kind of encourage good design practices instead of look at the square box.
Right.
Agree
with Yana. It would help avoid the cookie cutter look. Yeah. Potentially.
Some variation
in
designs.
Some variation. Yeah. Because one person, I mean, you know, some people are doing these more modern and urban looking types of structures. Well, they could pick a couple of things off this list and still get that urban look. Everything doesn't have to look craftsman or Northwest style. It can look, you know, it could be all glass. Somebody wants to build a glass house or whatever. But as long as it had a few of these elements, you know, it provides some design contrast or creativity.
I foresee us running into more, similar to with the ADU conversation, more design standards being implemented in the Washburn district.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I like the idea of a menu of options. It gives developers the ability to, and architects, you know, the ability to be creative, and mm-hmm. But also prevents the worst from happening.
Right.
So there is an exception to the clear and objective standard requirements, and that is for the historic district. Mm-hmm. So I would expect that all of the historic compatibility requirements would remain for the Washburn as it is in place now. Unless there's direction to do otherwise, but that's my understanding.
And so as we implement House Bill 2001 for the Washburn District, that can be built into it. So it still has to meet the design characteristics of the Washburn District.
That'll get them involved with the public hearings. Washburn District.
It will get them involved?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
If we change that, they would not like that.
Oh, sure, right.
There's actually quite a bit of existing middle housing in the Washburn District, because most historic mm-hmm. buildings and most historic neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. That's just how they were built, was with this middle housing. It wasn't until after World War II that we started going single unit dwellings versus apartments. There's some fun design standards to look at
And so would you see setting the bar differently for the, I'll just say triplexes and fourplexes versus just duplexes? I mean, and I'll just throw out the idea. So would meeting four of these for duplexes, but for fourplexes, we want to have at least six of these elements or something like that. I mean, or should we treat them all the same? Is there any input any of you have on that kind of a concept? I mean,
I think there should be some crossover with townhouses and duplexes, because there can be a duplex that can be built as, like, you know, an opportunity for, I don't know, like, a townhouse can be built as a duplex but be an opportunity for home ownership in that case, and so each would be on their individual lots but share a wall.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure, like, how extensive that crossover should be, but this bill is written in a way that somebody could build a duplex and have it be a townhouse.
I mean, technically a duplex is two units on one lot, but you're right, from not seeing the lot lines on the ground, it looks the same.
Yeah.
You don't know if there's a lot line. Yeah. So you're right. And or townhomes, a fourplex could be townhomes too. You could have four attached townhomes. It could be divided individual units or all on one lot. And you don't really know necessarily by looking on the ground, but
maybe, by unit number. Housing type.
It's kind of a nuance, and I'll just mention it, and I know, I'll just say it and you can take it for what it is, but so technically a duplex is one building, so they are attached, and a triplex is three units that's attached. So in my mind, for the code, I don't want to differentiate between three detached units on one lot versus, which technically wouldn't be a triplex, versus an actual triplex that's one building all attached on one lot. So I don't know if any, and same thing for duplex and fourplex. To me, it's the number of units on a lot versus whether they're actually attached or not. So I don't actually intend to use the words duplex, triplex, and fourplex in the code, but rather just talk about number of units on a lot. And so I don't know if that plays into any of the design considerations, but it could.
So they may be put together, but do they have to look the same? Can we do this to make them look differently even though they're combined?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a good question. Yeah. Do we care if
they? Individuality, it's a duplex or triplex.
You bring up an interesting point, because if it's three units, do those three units have to use the same designs from this selection, or can they be different?
One could be really modern, one could be a log cabin, and another one could look like a ski lodge or some three completely different styles all in one lot. Might look a little hectic in some people's minds.
I don't know if I'd build that or not, but it's an interesting idea.
So are you saying we should allow that flexibility?
No, I just asked the question.
Yeah, sure.
I would be okay at allowing that flexibility, right? Like if the goal is to choose, three off of the list, and then, you're saying, okay, there are technically three detached units, and you could choose a different three or a different combination of three. It doesn't bother me if they aren't perfectly uniform.
I mean, my general sense of direction I feel like I've gotten with this project as a whole, too, is to be less regulatory, in general. So, again, it's all finding this balance. But if we're trying to encourage more development, encourage creativity, and essentially, in my mind, get out of the way and let the market develop stuff that they see is going to work, being less heavy-handed about our regulations, I think, is kind of the side I, in my mindset for this project, am leaning on. But again, it's a fine balance on where we tip that scale or where ultimately the council is going to decide with the public input on how that should all be balanced.
So circling back to your question on two units versus four units, do they have additional items that they
shared. I just am looking in my head right now, and if we have the same size lot, the duplex has a potential of having larger, like if we have two exact same size lots, one has two units, one has four. The one with two units has the potential to have more building frontage, mm-hmm. and then we would be limiting, well, having a lower required amount, whereas a four unit property would have less potential frontage, and we're having more regulation on that. So I'm not sure if the more regulation on potentially smaller buildings would make it easier for someone to build a four unit structure.
Yeah. So are you, and maybe you're just asking the question, but so it sounds like you're saying they should be the same?
I would think so.
Okay.
I would move forward.
Okay. You know, it's interesting too, because it's not part of this, maybe it is part of this legislation, but other legislative mandates that were put in place by the state are to allow building code, to allow conversions of single family homes to multiple units. And I don't know if that's limited to duplexes or it could be.
I think it was part of the same legislation.
Yeah.
Yes.
So this whole idea.
It's up to four, I think.
Yeah, you could take an existing house and chop it up internally by whatever, corners or upstairs, downstairs, into a duplex, triplex, or fourplex. And so at that point, the house is what it is on the outside. They might add a stairway or something externally, or add some more front doors. You see these houses a lot of times where it looks like one big house, but it has two front doors side by side or something like that. But that, in my mind, is a little bit different because it's an existing structure. We're not going to probably tell them, now go add window trim or all this other stuff.
The exterior, it could be written in a way that qualifies as a non-conforming building. Because we have non-conforming buildings and non-conforming uses, and there's overlap, but they get confused. And so if you were to make a building, you would have to clarify that if a building was conforming as a single-family dwelling and it converts into a fourplex, that it doesn't lose its non-conforming, like it doesn't, isn't required to come up to current standards. Which would be the same as if I had a single family home, for example, and in the Washburn, for example, and my house is 3 feet away from the fence line, and the code requires it to be 5 feet away from the fence line, and I want to add a kitchen to the back. Well, I can add a kitchen to the back, and my kitchen can't get 3 feet. My kitchen has to step back, so it's 5 feet, but I have to tear down my whole living room wall to move it 2 feet away from the fence. So I think you could have the same type of process in place for that.
Potentially naive question, maybe, is if you're talking existing structure and someone converting that into a duplex internally,
right?
What would be the difference of that, like the garage, for example? Mm-hmm. What would be the difference, and where do we draw the line of this is now house built 2001 or this is an accessory dwelling unit?
I came up this week.
Did it? Well, and so maybe you want to talk.
Well,
about
so there really, I mean, there really isn't a difference unless we, as we're implementing that, we draw, I think, a size line or some other way to define it. But from at this point, the code doesn't. There is no code difference. So people have come in, like I was saying earlier, people have come in with new buildings or with added on buildings that are attached that they're calling an ADU and a primary, and as long as one is smaller than the other within that certain window per our code,
and the one is smaller than 800
and one is smaller than 800, correct, then it's an ADU. But if you have but in theory you could also build a duplex on a corner lot right now where you had an 800 square foot and a 1000 square foot, and so the same exact building footprint depending on where it is could be considered a duplex or an ADU under the code right now.
The one in my mind, almost with the full implementation of House Bill 2001, effectively ADUs kind of go away, and not entirely, but so one thing that's in place now that the council's decided is the SDC's waivers. So that's clearly an incentive to keep it 800 square feet or less. If and when that SDC waiver goes away, then why not build a 1,000 square foot second unit if it's all the same? I mean, So, and unless there's the difference, like, so with ADUs, the state tells us you can't require on-site parking for the ADUs. But for a duplex, we say, well, you do have to have an extra space. And so in adding a second unit to, say, an existing lot with the house, if they don't have room for the extra space, for the parking space, they may choose the ADU route because they don't have to have the extra parking space. So there's differences like that, but...
But effectively, it's up to the developer in the city to say, look, it's an ADU, or look, it's a duplex, right? Like,
where
depending.
Do you draw that line?
Well, I think what... Before this 2001 bill got passed, right. HB 2001, the way Mark and I were talking about the code update was to change it so we didn't have to have definitions of so many different things. You know, it doesn't really matter whether it's a duplex or if it's two units on the property or if it's a primary dwelling and an ADU. It doesn't matter because those definitions are irrelevant. All that really matters is there's two dwelling units on the property. How they're attached or not attached or their sizes, it's not really relevant. We set how many units. And then you can just regulate that. You have your standard setbacks and such. That's where we were going with the code. Now, the state coming in with regulations for a particular thing like the ADU that says you can't require on-site parking, well, then that means you have to define in our code what the state is defining in its code as an ADU if we want to have some cases where we do require on-site parking. So it's getting it's a little bit awkward now because, in a sense, we're trying to not define everything and have all these boundaries that are kind of manufactured anyway, but to some extent we're going to have to in order to respond to the state rules. And I hope I haven't lost you completely, but that's my attempt at explaining.
I think there's
an ability through staff report and findings to show we've complied with state law without having to have all of those definitions in the code, if that's what the officials want to do. So I think one way you could do that is if you want to have parking for larger units, for what we would think of as a duplex or a larger ADU, but you still want to comply with the state law, I think you would set parking based on the square footage of the second unit. And so you're not having to define, is it an ADU or a duplex? You're just looking at, is one of them less than 800 square feet per the state law? And then the staff report that adopts that regulation for future reference, you make it really clear that you're not using the word ADU, but that complies with the law because it meets that requirement.
And I think that's actually one of the most, like what we're talking about right now, maybe one of the most interesting questions to sort of flush out, right? Because the city's definitely gone a different way with ADUs, you know, in the past year. And it's like, okay, if we just wholesale apply those rules and just forget it and stop worrying about 800 square feet, like there's a lot of implications of that. But I mean, I like the idea of like, you know, getting rid of the definition so that we're not sort of choosing, right? But also maybe having, like, if you get to a certain size from a square footage perspective, having additional requirements. I do have a question in my head about, okay, from a policy perspective, what does that mean for, like, because the council is really proud of its SDC waiver, it's really proud of the ADU focus. It's like, okay, well, what does that mean down the road? But
well, in my mind, I'm thinking once you have this code in place, I don't know that you would want to maintain your SDC waiver. First of all, I don't know that you would need it anymore. Mm-hmm. And second of all, because we're not necessarily promoting this one little particular housing type, we're just promoting diversity of housing types, that maybe instead of doing an SDC waiver, you just relook at your SDCs and your methodology and make sure that it's right-sized for what you're actually building.
Well, and that may align perfectly with the fact that I think we set like a 3-year check-in to say, like, let's keep talking about it before we spend a ton of money. Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
there's
moving parts. There's a lot.
I mean, I think an SDC waiver is a great way to advertise this, and it does. I mean, we've had like 22 applications, I think, now is the recent number since we started. But I'm not seeing that being a permanent thing. You know, that was a temporary, it was intended to be temporary, but I never have conceived of it as a waiver, like, for all time in my mind. Because I think we're in a market where that was an extra incentive, but that's not necessarily appropriate in all markets.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I think there's some interesting questions there, right? Because, you know, about what we want to do and what we want the city to look like. I could see people ending up in a place where, like, that tiny home size, right, wanting to promote that and then not be as concerned, or, you know, even doing, like, a broader look at SDCs and trying to bring it down a little bit, so.
Okay, good conversation.
Well, sorry. I'll just make one more comment. Mm-hmm. I hadn't ever thought until what you two were talking about tying parking spaces to square footage in a residential context. You know, I've always, traditionally, it's based on units. It's not based on size of. So that's an interesting concept.
Yeah, and I mean, so state law says if it's 800 square foot or less, whether we call it an ADU or not.
I don't think they have the 800 square foot. That's not in state law.
I thought that was in their definition of an ADU.
I thought it was, too.
I can
write
it.
I don't think so.
Maybe it's not.
That's how we've defined it.
Yeah, right. But we could, I mean, we could say it's if it's not in here, we could say it's 800 feet or 600 square feet or whatever we draw that line.
Or we
could
say it's 2,400 square feet. I mean,
yeah,
you know.
Yes, or bigger. Yeah, I was going the one way.
I mean, my point was going to be that, say it is 800 in state law,
sure.
We could say, well,
yep, you're right,
if you're 1,000 square feet or less, you still don't have to put an extra parking space. Or we can determine where the threshold is for requiring another parking space or not, as long as we don't go awry of the state law that says you can't require a parking space for an ADU. I mean, we can figure out, I think, how we define an ADU and then which would be the trigger for when another parking space is required or not. Or we can just set another higher threshold for second units, whether it's an ADU or not, say as long as it's under 1,000 or 1,200 or whatever the number is for when that second parking space, or I guess technically a third parking space would be required. Because a single family home is supposed to have two. One of the things we have talked about just quickly is that in order to do an ADU, the state law says we can't require a parking space to be added for the ADU, but some jurisdictions around the state have talked about, well, but we can require the primary dwelling to have two spaces before we allow them to do the ADU. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So if an existing single family home has only one off-street parking space and they want to add an ADU, they still have to add a second one to meet the minimum of having two, at least for the existing single
because
family
two
home.
Is the otherwise the standard.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, it goes kind of the non-conforming thing, right. Christina was talking about, but it's a balancing act, so.
Well, we're on on-site parking requirements.
Mm-hmm.
I do see those regulations discouraging the development of, you know, multi-unit dwellings. You know, there are some, like I was working in Sweet Home earlier this year, and with their requirements, it's almost impossible to build a triplex because there's like no lots in the city that fit the size. So, I mean, just, I'm thinking like, even if like a single family residence has two parking spaces, like I grew up in a single family residence, and this is very anecdotal, but I mean, I'm sure you all have seen stuff like this where like every kid that's living there has a car and the parents have multiple cars. Like we had seven cars, which is like not what, you know, like the driveway was intended to accommodate. So now I live in an apartment that doesn't provide a parking space and I still own a car. So I'm just thinking about like to what point could parking, on-site parking minimums discourage the development and have us not see it, or discourage, you know, green space in the development because like there's no yard because there's on-site parking requirements.
Right.
We can't really regulate how many cars people have, but you know, I don't know. Just some food for thought. Wanted to hear your thoughts on that. You know, what could be too much for the lots that we have in Springfield?
Or like you said, discourage the type of housing we're trying to get from being built because the regulations aren't fitting or something. You know, parking is one of those hot topics. I worked on the 19th Street cluster development where they were putting in 10 units in the middle of a block in an existing neighborhood. And we ended up having a huge neighborhood meeting because the neighbors were all kind of very concerned about on-street parking and how is there going to be enough and on. But parking was on-street parking or on-site parking was definitely one of their hot button issues. And it kind of brings people to meetings. If you start talking about removing somebody's on-street parking in front of their house, but we're going to put a bike lane there. Sorry, you don't get on-street parking anymore. Or whatever it is, they are passionate about that subject. But I think you're right. Right-sizing that, and whether it's by unit size or number of bedrooms or, you know, the other thing we've talked about is or thought about is whether or not it's on a certain classification of street or not. So if it's on a street that has on-street parking versus on a street that doesn't have on-street parking. So some of those dynamics, I think, could come into play as well.
Have you thought about whether it's in a transit corridor?
Talking about proximity, like within walking distance. The one thing with transit is it can change. I mean, LTD is contemplating, you know, changing routes or, you know, so that is a bit of a moving target sometimes, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. We do have some protection in that we have some routes that are designated. I mean, as you know, because you're in the TSP, but in the TSP, and the TSP does designate certain places as frequent transit corridors.
That's good. That's a tough one, right? Because, you know, there's a lot of people that come to meetings about too many cars on the, and that's the first indicator, I think, of when people feel like there's too much density or it's overdeveloped or, you know, are worried about the renters or the neighbors. It's the local neighbors that show up. Outside of, I guess, like street classification, is there another way to cap, you know, how much street parking? Because I think in the ADU, don't they use that, like, you just have to show the availability of something, you know?
Based on, like, street frontage?
Yeah.
Along.
Right. The ADU is requiring that there be, that you can count your parking space that's needed for the ADU on street, if there's on-street parking on both sides of the street. Or if there's not on-street parking on both sides, but you still think there's enough parking on the street, you can do a parking study. And that's a type 2 where people can comment as to whether there is enough on the street to accommodate your parking space. I mean, you always have the option of providing it on-site as well.
Yeah. So when you go up in building size, right, doesn't it go to frequency per unit? Right, so if I built an apartment complex, isn't it like, you know, I don't know what it is, point?
0.5 per unit, 0.5 spaces per unit if you're like a 40-unit apartment building or something. But usually the frequency goes down the higher the units.
Right, okay. I don't know if that helps us. Right, because I'm kind of thinking in that triplex scenario, right? Like, because we've already sort of said, okay, if you're basically building a duplex, we can let you use, you know, count street parking, right? That's that ADU question. Now I'm kind of thinking, okay, if I picture a triplex, how many is the right amount of parking spaces?
Or a fourplex. And are they one-bedroom units or are they two or three-bedroom units?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you take the ADU a little bit more, we're saying that it's on the street adjacent to your lot.
Okay.
So if you had 60-foot of frontage and you've got 20-foot for a driveway, that gives you 40 feet left. That's enough for two on-street parking spaces. But if you've got 60-foot of frontage and you have four units in there, you're only going to still get two on-street parking spaces that would count the way that we did it for the ADUs. So you're going to have more on-site per unit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so
you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know. I'm just kind of like, there's about 10 different scenarios that are going through my head, right? So, like, if you, like, I'm kind of concerned about the overall neighborhood livability here, yeah. right? Like, you know, if nobody had a driveway, right, everybody would be in the street, right, and it would look, you know, feel terrible to people.
But actually, if you don't have driveways, you've got more on-street parking because yeah. you're not using up that space for your driveway.
Right. So, but also the smaller the unit, right, lower the bedrooms, the smaller the family, the less of the need. So, like, it's almost like if the square footage, like on a triplex and duplex, gets really high into that, like, three-bedroom range, right, like, we almost want to ramp up, right? Like, but if it's, they're really tiny, if I built three baby homes, maybe I'm less concerned.
Right. I mean, there's even, some of the language I've written already is if they're alley access or not. So, I mean, if you don't even have a driveway mm-hmm. on the street frontage, but your alley access lot is actually encouraging that. And so some of that, you know, might increase your frontage, so there's on-street parking, but you're right, there's multiple different scenarios. But again, trying to have it written in a way that works for all these multiple scenarios, and then right-sizing it, but providing the flexibility.
When you talk about street types, that brings me back to the Main Street Safety Project and how the segment of Main Street we're looking at has just an insane amount of access points, which makes it more dangerous. So it's like, all right, how do we minimize these access points to make it safer, but also how do we encourage development? But then, you know, how do we make sure that there's not parking conflicts? There's a lot of things to think about as far as everything in planning comes down to parking, I think.
Well, or you start talking about closing accesses, that's a whole other level up from talking about taking people's parking. Mm-hmm. Well, it's good feedback. You can appreciate some of the struggles I'm dealing with in writing the code to make it work. And getting back to the point of not having it super refined is when we do release the public review draft of having ranges or options, or here's a couple different ways. So instead of having it dialed in, we might say, here's one way, here's, you know, again, and I think of how high we set the bar. And Sandy kind of alluded to this too, is we're required by state law to have clear and objective standards for housing. So where we set those clear and objective standards, but always having the pressure release valve of an alternative tract, that if they can't meet or don't like the clear and objective standards, there's the alternative tract of discretionary land use process they can go through to get something different that could still potentially work. So again, it's right sizing the clear and objective standards and still writing that other tract to give people an option.
And that discretionary tract has a level, you know, a bar as well. The criticism that Eugene frequently gets is that it's both of its levels are very high, so they push a lot of people out. I mean, anecdotally, push a lot of people out of clear and objective review because it's hard to meet, and then their discretionary review is very, just a very high bar as well.
Yeah.
I always think clear and objective is tough, right? Because it's black or white, right? Like the lights on or left, the lights off. If it's legal, like I would be open to, like, you know, when you talk about frequencies, right? Like you have rounding problems, and you have other sort of issues where where you're like, okay, if you just follow the letter of the law, it just makes no sense here. I'm actually open to if we could build a little bit of wiggle room, right? So if our goal is, I don't know, one parking space, right, and somebody came in at 0.95 and, you know, just doesn't make sense to add another parking space, I'm actually good, but giving them a little bit of a range they have to hit so that we don't have that, like, the bar is so high, you know, the discretionary path so high, we might as well do discretionary.
And as long as that range applies to everyone equally, so we're not deciding that they get the wiggle room in this case because of these factors, but this other person doesn't get the wiggle room because they have a different context, as long as we're not doing that balancing, that type of process can work legally.
But if we say for triplexes, you have to have one space per unit, but for fourplexes, maybe you can have 0.9 to 1.1 spaces per unit or something. I mean, there's ways to write it to get flexibility even within the clear and objective standards.
Right.
Yeah.
This is regressing a little bit, and I think it was a think it was a planning commission conversation. We were talking about like making the code like easy to read for anybody who may pick it up, you know, like the homeowner that has extra space on their lot or like the professional planning consultant. And something that I really appreciate is taking out these definitions and just going by unit, because it is making it more approachable to read and, you know, provides better customer service at the counter. You know, having clear and objective standards does that, but how do we make the code written in a way that it's like doesn't give people headaches and doesn't force them to hire a planning consultant? And yeah, that having it boil down to units, I think, really helps out with that.
I had this pulled up already, but these are the objectives for the project, and you're right. So provide easy to understand code language, present in a clear and user-friendly format. So we're definitely striving for that. One of the things we've learned a little bit through the TSP implementation project in trying getting to the point for clear and objective standards is that purely for clear and objective standards to meet state law doesn't mean easy to use or written in a way that's easy to understand. So it's been a very tricky balance to figure out how to both meet state law of writing stuff that's legally clear and objective, but also having it be written in a way that's easy to use and understand and doesn't require somebody to go hire an engineer or an attorney or some other consultant to decipher what this 10-page diatribe of code language to be clear and objective means. So that it's a tricky balance. And it's thankfully we have a land use attorney on our team to help us, and we bounce stuff off and back and forth and try and figure it out. But it'll be kind of the litmus test to, again, release the public review draft and start getting that feedback, getting people with different lenses looking at it and giving us that where we didn't quite get it right.
The TSP has been a good trial run.
It has been.
Writing some clear and objective standards and getting input from Planning Commission and Council.
So we have a little bit of time left. There was one other, along the same train of conversation, but a little bit different spin on it, and that is, so Sandy talked about where we were kind of originally talking about going with the code prior to implementation of House Bill 2001. We were already talking about the fact that we allow duplexes on corner lots now, and we were going down the road of saying, okay, now we're going to allow duplexes mid-block. And we've heard this comment, why just confine to corner lots? And Commissioner McKinney mentioned in the historic district, there's middle housing all over the historic district, not just on corner lots or whatever. So with the concept now that we have to allow duplexes on every lot, the second piece of the legislation is we also have to allow the other middle housing types, the triplexes, fourplexes, cottage housing, in every area. And that's very subjective. We don't know what that
means.
I did
do some legal research. I hadn't typed it up and sent it out yet, but I did do some legal research on, there's obviously, it's not been implemented. There's no case law or definition for this bill, but this areas zoned for or area word comes up in a lot of other state laws, and the way that it tends to be used is as an alternative to zoning district, because there has been sort of hair splitting about whether something was like a zone or a district or not. So if you look at other contexts, so the context matters for interpreting statutes. I think it's safe to say that areas zoned for single family dwellings could be interpreted legally to mean within all of our zoning designations, all of our, like our low density residential, medium density residential, and high density residential, rather than requiring us to draw neighborhood type lines on a map.
So with that, some of the discussion is around, so how should, and I'll just use fourplexes as the example, but it could be triplexes or cottage housing, the other types. So should we now allow fourplexes on every corner lot? Should we limit it to that? And that would meet the test of allowing those housing types in every area. So trying to figure out what these, how the siting standards part of our regulations are for these other, beyond the duplexes are, or should we, allow fourplexes even mid-block? And so And we don't have to figure this out today. I'm just throwing it out as these are the concepts we're talking about, and I'll be taking these ideas to my TAC. But these are some of the things of figuring out how to implement this legislation into the existing neighborhoods. And again, keeping in mind the context of allowing existing homes to be converted to these multiplexes now as well. So can some big house mid-block on a street in an existing neighborhood convert that big house into a multiplex? Or does it, can we only, do we only allow that on corner lots for some reason, thinking corner lots are a magical place to have multiplexes? So anyway, or, you know, Sandy and I have talked, and she was talking a bit ago about just density in general. So as long as you're within the density range for the zone, that we don't care how and where you really do the unit. So one thought I've had is, you know, you draw an artificial square, say, centered over the lot you want to build it on. And as long as the density within, whether it's a one block radius or a 1,000-foot radius of that lot, if you somehow do an average density calculation within this area, and you're not going to kick over the maximum density for the zone in that defined area, then you get to do it. So it doesn't matter which type of lot, whether it's corner or mid-block or not. So anyway, some of that's swirling around and trying to figure out, or maybe it's purely just lot size. It's like, okay, you want to do a fourplex, your lot to meet maximum density, your lot size has to be at least this, and then you can do it wherever there's a lot big enough to do those four units.
How is something like that managed today? I mean, does it just never come up because of the, because it's in corner lots?
Well, so
like an area, like a neighborhood would because of a development would exceed its density?
So the maximum so in our low density residential zone, you can only do duplexes. You can't do triplexes or fourplexes. And you can only do those duplexes on corner lots as long as they're 6,000 square foot lot size. So that keeps them within the density as long as it's 6,000. Now in our medium density residential zone, for multifamily, it would be regulated by lot size, by density. So as long as your lot size was big enough for the number of units, it would determine the number of units you could put on that lot.
And that would keep you under the density.
Right.
But we're going to run into that problem because now suddenly you can put them anywhere, right? So you have, you don't have a natural sort of governor to density.
Well, you can put the duplexes anywhere.
Right.
So that's, like we mentioned, in theory, you're going to exceed your density potentially in some areas over time. And so if everybody's put a duplex in a neighborhood all of a sudden and somebody wants to come in and plop down a fourplex because their lot's big enough, if we say it's some average density, well, they're not going to meet it because the average density of the neighborhood is too high versus just using the lot size provision. The problem is with the low density residential zone. I guess in theory you'd have to have a like a 12,000 square foot lot to be able to do a fourplex in the low density residential zone.
Yeah, like with maximum lot coverage and then height requirements and setback requirements, like some lots just won't be able to fit a certain amount of units on it. So it's almost as if, you know, we lean towards regulating less and just saying, you know, like here are the standards for the type of building that can be put on this lot, like then it'll regulate itself how many units go on it. But I think where we might want to, you know, look at siting and design standards is the classic example of like the small, not small, but you know, the little historic house that's next to like giant new duplex, you know, like the picture West University over across the river. You know, just maybe like how do we celebrate the character that's already been built and also not limit investment in our community through development. But I mean, I think as long as we stick with, yeah, like height restrictions and maximum lot coverage, then it just won't pencil out for as many units.
Mm-hmm. I think what's interesting too is this conversation, I think, would need to tie back into the parking. I can see where right now duplexes being allowed on corners makes sense because there's a lot more street parking available. You have two different streets that you're polluting, for lack of a better word. whereas a fourplex, you're going to have a lot more parking potentially. And so having it on restricted two corner lots, that filters out the parking from just one street to two. So I'm not sure if I have the correct answer, but that I feel like I am personally leaning more towards keeping it on corners just for that specific, for parking.
And not to, to play devil's advocate for a minute, and that is sometimes, depending on the classification of the streets on the corner, having more traffic at the corner can create congestion issues with intersections and stuff. If it's local streets, it's not as big of a deal usually, but if you have a fourplex right on a corner that has stop signs and more traffic, sometimes there can be more conflicts because of people pulling in and out, but anyway.
I think that's my biggest takeaway from our conversation today is parking.
Yeah.
Just because, just anecdotally on a personal level, we have happened to have a duplex across from us, which is not typical for the neighborhood.
Right.
And they have a bunch of cars, which makes it difficult for us, my husband and I, to get in and out.
Yeah.
And we're not really big fans of that. Some of them don't move. So that's, I think that's where, from my personal experience, where that's coming from is the parking needing to really be definitely assessed, because it could quickly change the feel and appearance of a neighborhood, of an established neighborhood.
Yeah.
I think also to play devil's advocate there, you know, last year I lived with four other girls in a single family house, you know, near the university, and we had one parking space, and like, even though it was a single family house, you know, we each had cars, and you know, like, we had a lot of cars there. So it ultimately comes down to like who's living in the unit, rather than housing type. With the way that cities are structured now, and you know, most people have a car, but you know, the amount doesn't necessarily boil down to the type of.
Other thoughts? Did you want to say something? I'm leaning towards kind of having the lot size regulate, really. I mean, that fits the density parameter. So if there is a mid-block 12,000 square foot lot, they can fit four units. But again, you're right, what I call the building envelope, the setbacks and the height and everything, and then all your other on-site requirements is, again, I say it a lot, but the right sizing of all those other provisions is going to play into it.
And that may be the check as this whole conversation goes forward, right? Because in, like, it seems like in these sort of planning and transportation conversations, we always end up in this spot going, okay, technically it's legal, but if you actually played it out, you would never see a scenario like that because something physically is wrong.
Which we hear a lot about with our existing code. And I mean, from my perspective, the way I've started drafting the new code provisions is to ease up a lot of what is these artificial constraints. A lot of this feedback I've gotten from my technical advisor committee is, you know, it's not just one provision or the other provision, but it's, you start stacking them on top of each other, and it's so confined that stuff can't happen. And it's not so much our low density residential zone. But now that we're going to be introducing more middle housing into our low-density residential zone, it's not wanting to create that problem again now in that zone. So. Good. Well, we can end early. That's about the extent of the subject matter I had to talk about today. I don't know if anybody else has other thoughts or ideas or want to pick your guys' brains. You're our brain trust here today, so we definitely appreciate it. I forgot to mention at the beginning, there's food to fuel your brains if you guys need a little snack or water over there, but now that we're almost done. So, but I'm open to listen longer or hear more thoughts that any of you have. So I want to talk about anything else.
One of my goals when I went to council was to hopefully we could relax the building code so that more average people could understand it. And I I know that's very hard. It's still very complex, but maybe more of them can be look at it and get an idea what they need to do. But we just do the best we can.
Yeah. So easier to understand all the provisions.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know I heard once, and I don't know if it's still true, but that newspapers are generally written or used to be written in like a fourth grade reading level.
Yeah.
And so that's the mindset I have with our code. It's like anybody should be able to pick up our code and read it and be able to understand it. I know it's probably in theory not exactly
right.
true yeah. to get it there, but we can try.
And I know that.
Yeah, the easier we can make it. And it's definitely not there today. And there's more to that than just the words on the paper. It's the structure and how it's organized. And I think our code has a lot of opportunity to just fix that. I think even just reformatting and restructuring it, reorganizing it, will get us a long way towards making it easier to use as well.
Well, and I'll just add that, you know, Mark is taking on the development code as an update, but there are building codes that also affect what can be built, and those are at the state level, and so, you know, we have no control over building codes. Those are what contractors are going to have to comply with, and that's going to still be there, but at least with the development code, maybe we can make that part a little bit more accessible.
It's been a challenge. So, and I'll just mention this dynamic because, so we have our construction specifications for, say, infrastructure in our EDSPM, Engineering Design Manual. I know I've at least heard the message from the mayor and some of the other counselors about we want everything all in one place. And we want to make our code shorter. But so, there will continue to be an EDSPM, there will continue to be an engineering design standard manual that has how much base rock you need to put under concrete or asphalt for parking or driveways or roads and all this stuff, that we don't want to clutter the actual development code with some of that stuff. So we're also looking at opportunities to just, in terms of user friendliness, how to make our electronic access to our codes and the links and the interplay between them more functional and more user-friendly. So I think that's some of it. Anyway, there's a lot, like somebody said a little while ago, there's a lot of moving parts. It's a big puzzle and there's a lot of pieces, and trying to get them all fit together in a way that makes sense and creates a picture we can all live with. So.
We don't have to get it all solved today.
Nope. But I definitely appreciate all the input. It's helpful for me to get your guys' thoughts and opinions, so I appreciate your time.
Did you want to get the December meeting scheduled?
Yeah, so here? We do, in terms of next steps, I don't know that we need to do it today if you're all prepared to talk about it next. So our next meeting is scheduled for October 16th, so about 5 weeks from now. Last time we scheduled them out. AJ and Brenda helped me get all four of your schedules coordinated. But we would like, I mean, their input to me was if we can get the four of you sitting at the table to schedule them while we're here, that would be a lot easier. So beyond the October 16th date, if we could find a date, I would like to do it probably again in November before the holidays start in earnest. I have a check-in, again, scheduled with the City Council and Planning Commission at the beginning of December. So thinking about Thanksgiving being on the 28th, if we could shoot for the week of, like, November 18th to the 22nd, that'd be about a month after our October meeting. So I don't know what you all think about that, if people are leaving town prior to the holidays and that kind of stuff, but the week of the 18th to the 22nd could be a good week to shoot for.
Just looking at my schedule right now, I'm actually pretty flexible that week.
I will definitely be out the 22nd, so probably the 21st is the latest that I could do it.
Okay. Anybody else with limitations there? Not hearing any. I'm going to get to my schedule.
Is there a date you can propose now?
Yeah, let me but.
We do have Planning Commission 19th on the calendar.
You do?
Yes. But these meetings are often held before that.
Would it make sense to do this meeting for you, Sophie, to stack them on top of each other the same afternoon, or is that more troublesome?
There's going to be a gap between them anyway, because the earliest Planning Commission starts is 6 if there's a work session typically.
And give them an hour to shift gears or something. If we tried to do Tuesday the 19th from 3 to 5,
yeah, I could do that. I mean, I always prefer these to be later because I do have to flex my time. So, like, I'm going back into work after this. So,
if we did like a 4 to 6 time, and or maybe 4 to 5:30, we don't have to. We didn't use the full 2 hours today, and we could try and keep it to an hour and a half the next time. But we could do 4 to 5:30 on the 19th. Would that?
Yeah, I mean, the later the better for me, always. But yeah, I'm available that day.
What do people think about that? I'm seeing head nods.
Yeah, set up whatever you can.
Okay.
Here, if I can get it on my calendar, which this one wasn't. So text me, save me, thank you.
I got you covered.
So I'm going to say Tuesday, November 19th from 4 to 5:30, and we'll send out those invites. Okay. Great. And then I'll just, lastly, just quickly is, I mentioned it, but I'm going to the city council on, I have the date written down, the 23rd, and then checking in with the planning commission on October 1st. So those, you as your entire respective bodies will hear more of all this at those meetings coming soon. So.
We've heard it already. Yeah. That means we get to get.
Those will be work sessions. Thanks a bunch for your time. We can be done.